Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game and, unlike every other pod I'm involved in, has no interest in the Roy in, Roy out debate. I'm Kevin Day. He is Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Seriously, Croydon. I was in Croydon yesterday and two people just sidled up to me and out of the corner of their mouth went, Roy in, Roy out. It's like, mate, I'm queuing for Waitrose. This is not the time or place, basically.
Hold it. You say Waitrose. You're just giving it away that you've joined the Condescenti.
Kieran, I've always been with Nye Bevan, only the best of the working classes, Kieran. It's the peasants that make the champagne. It should be the peasants that drink the champagne. The fact that you and I have never actually produced anything in our entire life is neither here nor there. Later in this episode, Kieran, we will hear from Brett Johnson, the new owner of Ipswich Town, and a very, very interesting chat it is. He seems like a very nice man, and he was very open and very honest with us, and I think Ipswich fans will enjoy that conversation. But before that, it's Newsday, and before that, Kieran, I have one big question, and that is, has your dog Finlay got himself a Wonky Chomps deal yet?
Well, sadly not. I was hoping after the... After his revelations the other day, when he twice decided to interfere with the podcast by opening and closing the doors with a Wonky Chomp, that they might have picked up on him. He is quite a poster boy as well. He's very photogenic, but I'm hoping that somebody's tipping him the wink, but not yet.
Yeah, he's a handsome little fella, and I hope in my imagination that he once had a relationship with a Borzoi in Moscow. Do you know, it's just occurred to me, Kieran, that Brett Johnson, the new owner of Ipswich, may be listening to this in America, wondering if he's made a wise decision. Roy in, Roy out, Wonky Chomps, Borzois. Speaking of Ipswich, Kieran, they will no doubt be delighted to learn that Premier League clubs are £83 million better off thanks to Norwich and Watford.
Yes, this is all to do with parachute payments. And we've seen Norwich and Watford, deservedly, because ultimately they played the best football in the division, go straight back up to the Premier League. And they could be joined by one of Swansea and Bournemouth, both of whom are also in receipt of parachute payments potentially next season as well. But the reason why this has created what can be best described as a minor kerfuffle is that somebody went on Twitter and said, well, you do realise that if they're not in receipt of parachute payments next season, that money goes back to the Premier League and it is then shared out between all 20 clubs because it is the Premier League's relegation pot as far as they are concerned. And on the back of that, I think some people seem to be a bit upset and saying, well, hold on, should that money actually be shared out further down the football pyramid? There's a case for saying it should be given to clubs in the EFL. I think there's a bit of an issue here, though, because the EFL itself has, my understanding, it has parachute payments and it deals with them in exactly the same way. So if a club drops out of the EFL and goes into the National League and comes straight back up, or if it, you know, and then the money wouldn't be split between the clubs. So I think it's, you know, partly due to this sort of legacy approach. It's a horrible word to use, legacy, these days, since Florentino Perez sort of completely tarnished it. You know, you and I are now legacy football fans, Kevin. We are not what the billionaires are looking for.
So if Norwich and Watford are promoted, so they have been, of course, so they're in the Premier League. So does that mean they will also get a share of this £83 million? So will they get some of this money anyway?
Yes. So they would have received it in 2021-22 and in the case of Watford 2022-23 out of the Premier League's relegation fund. But as they're no longer relegated, that money goes back into the big pot. I think the argument being put forward, and you can understand the merits of it, is that Well, you know, that £83 million, which could go up to in excess of 100 if Bournemouth are also promoted, is that better off further down football? We know that the clubs in the EFL have struggled, and you can see the case that they will put forward. The Premier League will argue, well, hold on, you know, we have given grants to clubs in the Premier League in Leagues 1 and 2. We have guaranteed loans to clubs in the Championship. And also, we are losing huge amounts of money ourselves. So there's a case for both sides. I think from a public relations point of view, it would be a decent thing to do from the Premier League's perspective. I think it would show an indication that when certainly at least some of the clubs in that division have not conducted themselves in a particularly good light recently, to show that, yes, we are aware of those who have far less wealth than we do. So I suspect that the Premier League will become very tight-lipped and not talk to anybody about this on the grounds that if you say nothing, then hopefully people forget about it.
Yeah, it wouldn't only be a good PR move from the six clubs that you're referring to, but considering the other 14 clubs bandied the word greed about very often last week, it would be a good PR move from them as well. But obviously, if it wasn't during a pandemic, you'd imagine they'd be more inclined to spread the money about. There's every chance that Bournemouth could come up again, meaning I think it would be the first time, you know me and research, that all three relegated clubs came straight back. But it seems to be more proof, Kieran, that the best way to get into the Premier League is to be relegated from it the previous year, doesn't it?
It certainly can help on occasion. At the same time, we have seen Sunderland go straight through to League One. Wolves did the same a few years ago. It wasn't that long ago that Bolton Wanderers were in the Premier League, and now they're in League Two. So it's no guarantee. I was watching the Leicester versus Palace match on Monday night.
Oh yeah, and you thought you had to crowbar that in, did you?
And as soon as Palace scored, I went off in a sulk, as you can imagine. So I thought, oh, I'm not going to watch this. This could really ruin my Monday night. So I revved up the old spreadsheet just to try to see what would happen if we scrapped parachute payments, gave 25% of the TV deal to the clubs in the EFL, which would be clearly of benefit to those clubs. We didn't have any of the clubs being able to sell their own rights. But that produces huge discrepancies within the Premier League itself. And the gap that exists is very large. So I thought, well, hold on. Let's apply the NFL model. And in the NFL, 60% of gate receipts goes to the home club, and 40% goes into a pool. And remember, this isn't hugely different from where we were, you know, in the mid-1980s.
Yeah.
And also, as far as merchandising receipts are concerned, that money is pooled as well. So I thought, yeah, let's just see whether the numbers work out. Clubs, and I can keep the broadcasting as it is, as far as the Premier League is concerned, and also those clubs that qualify for the Champions League, let them keep all of their broadcast money. And it did produce some interesting figures. It would considerably narrow the gap between the top and the bottom at both the Premier League and the EFL Championship. But the gap between the bottom of the Premier League and the top of the Championship would still be quite significant. So it would address some of the imbalances that we presently have within divisions. But the big one, which I think gives the EFL clubs most consternation, is that gap between divisions. So it can be done. Certainly, I do think that there is scope for a better division of wealth. And I put this out on social media, and somebody says, hold on, has your Twitter account been taken over by Jeremy Corbyn? And I'm going, well, no, it isn't, because it would still mean that the club at the top of the Premier League has 3.5 times the revenue as the side at the bottom, as opposed to presently where it's 5 times. So it's a question of degree. And if we want to have a mature conversation on this, it's not a case of, you know, 1 or 10 on a scale. It needs to be more nuanced than that. But I suppose there are better ways and better places to debate that than social media. So, yeah, my fault to a certain extent.
Well, also, in the old days, Kieran, instead of saying, have you been taken away by Jeremy Corbyn, he would have said, well, why don't you go and live in Russia then? And we would have been here all day answering that question. If it's any consolation, Kieran, I went off in the sulk when Wolf scored on Monday night.
Did you?
Because it was way too early. So I really was. What was he thinking of? It's like, seriously. And it's just typical Palace. Like, well, we've done a good thing. Well, we won't do that again for the rest of the game, will we? They've got that off their chest early. But no, as you crowbar in Palace losing, I'll crowbar in that what you really want to do is score in the 95th and a half minute. Away
with your second shot of the match.
With the second shot of the match. It's Kieran, it doesn't say that in the records at the end of the season, does it? It
just says, I know.
Still with the Premier League, and they want to scrap their upcoming domestic media rights auction. Is that because they know they won't get as much money as they hope?
Well, that's partly. This is a story which came from the Financial Times. And you know, I think it's indicative of just where we are in the fact that, you know, in 2021, that football's even mentioned in the FT, because I can assure you, when I first started reading it, a good few decades ago, it was just, you know, not seen as anything other than a joke industry. But if we take a look at the auctions for the Premier League rights, in 2013, they went up by 70%, and in 2016, they went up by 70%. So there was Sky and BT who were fighting for space on your TV and using the football as a means of doing it. And then they realized that actually it's probably not a wise way to behave. All we're doing is we're incurring huge costs, and ultimately, there's a fixed number of people willing to watch football. So in 2019, the value of the rights fell domestically by 10%. And we should normally have heard about the new Premier League TV deal that's due to start in 2022. So we're only 14, 15 months before that kicks in. Reading the Financial Times, it sort of hinted that there were some clubs, and I think we can guess which 6 clubs this might involve, some clubs seem to be wanting to delay those negotiations. And this is because the reason why Sky and BT play the rights, some of the football is absolutely amazing, and the coverage, I think, from both channels is top draw. But the fight for Champions League places does drive a lot of interest in terms of viewing figures. And of course, what would not be happening next season would be the fight for the top four, because if the 6 clubs have got their way, they've automatically qualified. So you know, why are we watching a match? You know, if it was West Brom versus Spurs, would I be watching? If Spurs were 5th but guaranteed a place in the Super League, and West Brom, I might even go out for a walk with the Baroness in sort of trying to save my marriage as opposed to.
Well, do you know what, Kieran? If you're trying to save your marriage, I wouldn't turn off the Leicester Palace game and switch on a spreadsheet. That'd partly be my advice. The Baroness must have got all, she must have thought, oh, Palace was scored early. He's got the hump. He might spend some quality. No, he's got a spreadsheet out there. Okay.
So what the Premier League are hoping to do, and under normal circumstances, they might be a bit wary of this, because under competition law, they have to be seen to be going to a fair method, a fair auction of the rights. But what they're hoping to do, sort of on the back of COVID, on the back that, you know, quite a few of the clubs still have some positive vibes from the government because they've not used the furlough. And therefore, you know, they have been seen that they have showed some financial responsibility, is to roll over and repeat, which No, I won't say that. I won't go down that particular rabbit hole. But to roll over and repeat the existing relationship they have with their senior partners in the form of Sky, BT, and Amazon, and hoping to keep the same amount of money. So we would drop from having every single match on television, as we have at present, to just 200. In theory, it would involve a return to 3 p.m. kickoffs with a blackout, although, again, that could be up for debate, and actually have matches taking place at the same time, which is something which we've not experienced for 8 or 9 months. So, there are these proposals. And if they did that, I think actually it'd be pretty good value as far from the Premier League's point of view, because the French TV deal has collapsed. The German deal's down around about 10% at least. Italy and Spain aren't looking great. If I was the Premier League and Sky and BT offered the same money, my gut reaction as a completely independent and unassuming observer would be to say, snap the hands off.
It's funny. I think most football fans counterintuitively would breathe a huge sigh of relief if you couldn't watch every game. I think that would be so relaxing. But also, do you know what? It's very interesting. It's never occurred to me before, Kieran, when you talk about there's only a fixed number of people who want to watch football, that idea of attracting new fans to watch football on TV, because most subscriptions, of course, will be in households. You'll have parents watching the football with 2-3 children, and it will be possibly 20 years before those children are old enough to be in their own household subscribing as well. So it's never occurred to me that it's very difficult to attract new people, because every football fan you imagine would be, I know there are people who out of protest won't have Sky or BT subscriptions, and that's absolutely fine and understandable. But for the most part, everybody who wants to watch football is already subscribing to something. So attracting new viewers is a very difficult thing for them, isn't it?
And the big fear of the broadcasters is people cutting the cord. And football is the equivalent of, I'm trying to remember this, was it Soma in Brave New World that Aldous Huxley used to write about?
Like many books, Kieran, I read it when I had to read it and then decided to read things I wanted to read, so I could Google
it. I loved it.
That's part of the whole world of literature. Some things we like, some things we don't. I mean, I could Google it, Kieran, but as it happens, I don't know how to Google stuff when I'm recording things, so that's a sign of our old man. And you mentioned social media earlier. You caused quite a stir from anxious Liverpool fans when you talked about their latest set of accounts, which had just been released.
Well, yes. I mean, I think they're actually in the context of a Premier League which is in the middle of a pandemic, they're quite solid results. So on a day-to-day basis, they lost 74 million quid last year. They managed to reduce that by about a third by a couple of player sales. The fact that their losses were lower than those of Bournemouth and Southampton in terms of operations is, I think, testament to just how crazy things got last year. And I would stress to everybody, do not take any of the accounts from clubs for last year too seriously, because the COVID distortions in terms of you've only got 31 games in the Premier League, for example, up to the 31st of May when Liverpool's accounts ended, whereas normally you'd have a full season in. So all the TV money from the last 7 games won't be included. Some of the prize money won't be included. Yeah, there are bits and pieces there which just make the numbers be wary of them. That's all I would say. And let's return to things over a period of 2 or 3 years due to the COVID distortions. The most important thing is that Liverpool Football Club is still in existence. And as far as last year is concerned, just remember it as being the year in which Liverpool won the Premier League. Don't worry about the numbers.
Absolutely. How much would John Peel have liked a band called the COVID Distortions? He'd been all over them. And for those of you wondering, by the way, my favourite novel is The Master and Margarita by Paul Karkoff, which is arguably the best book ever written, I would say, Kieran. But I've never mentioned it to you before because it's set in Moscow. So it's
I'm gonna get hold of it now.
It's, oh, you'll like it. It's got a, yeah, go on.
Is it better than Who Are You?
Who Are You is not a novel, Kieran, is it?
It's true.
I would not put my own book ahead of The Master and Margarita. The sarcastic cat is one of the finest characters in any fiction. Swansea City have also put out their figures. I don't know why. Every now and again, I'm slightly baffled as to why producer Guy picks a club and mentions it. I always assume it's because there's a problem.
It's not a problem, and nobody will see this as an issue apart from me. What I really dislike is where clubs don't actually put out their accounts. They put out a one-page press release which says, these are the numbers in the accounts we want to show to you. Because my first reaction is, well, this is what you want to show to me. Mm. There must be something that you don't want to show to me. So Swansea made a profit of £2.7 million, and people say, well, that's fantastic. Over 2019-20, yes, they were receiving the parachute payments, but that includes player sales. So, you can accelerate or decelerate player sales to boost your profits or reduce your profits as you see fit. It was noticeable there was a bit of a negative hit on staff numbers, but again, that unfortunately is a function of clubs being relegated, and this is one thing which I think people don't see when clubs go down, because normally you say, well, yeah, clubs go down, clubs go up, things replace each other. But when big clubs go down, the likes of Aston Villa and Sunderland, which are pretty big in the city which they represent, the impact on jobs at the club is huge. So Swansea took a hit in terms of jobs. But remember, another club was promoted, so there'll be more jobs replacing it in that town. It's just that when the big clubs go down, the overall impact of employment within the football industry is actually negative.
Mm. It's not the first time this season we've talked about data breaches, Kieran, but this is quite a serious one. Hundreds of Football Index investors have had their identities revealed by somebody who really shouldn't be revealing people's identities.
Yes. The government does take us to task in terms of, we should be trying harder in terms of protecting our own online persona, and there's big advertising campaigns out, and there is evidence that there are rogue nations out of there, and I don't want to mention Moscow yet again. Mm-hmm. But certainly people who are trying to get hold of our information. Well, under those circumstances, if you are sending out an email to people who have lost money through their relationship with Football Index, use the blind copy option, which is available for all emails, and then to go and send out another email half an hour later to say, we now realise we have given you the email addresses of every other person that's contacted us in terms of losing money. That's actually quite sensitive, because if I'd been involved, perhaps I would not have wanted the world and his wife to know I've been involved with Football Index, potentially lost a hell of a lot of money. Something, if people want to publicise it, that's their right. If people want to say, I really need to keep this quiet, because what happens in those circumstances, and I'm not saying that this is right or wrong, where you have lost a lot of money and you've not told your spouse, or you've not told the rest of the family, and you're looking at a five-figure loss. And all of a sudden, it goes out to everybody. It gets passed around on WhatsApp groups, or it now appears on, it turns up on Facebook. Oh, did you go and see that Joe from down the road lost 40 grand? And then their partner will say, Joe, need a little bit of a word about this. It was an error. There was no malice involved, but the government really needs to be setting the standards in respect of this type of thing.
Of course they do, Kieran, because it's not long since that the government forced TV production companies, for example, to spend hundreds of thousands of pounds on software, etc., to make sure that their data were secure. And for them to do this, mistake or otherwise, it doesn't fill you with absolute confidence, does it? Our next story, Kieran, is in a part of our occasional series called Closing the Stable Door After the Horse Has Bolted.
The Italian More Football than occasional
Federation,
these days.
Yes, absolutely. The Italian Football Federation has approved a rule that would ban clubs who sign up to breakaway competitions from competing in Serie A. And you know my problem with this, Kieran, and I understand why they're doing it, but do you not then risk that you force those clubs into an actual Super League? In future, if clubs like the Milan clubs and Juventus and Roma say, right, well, if we're going to get banned, we need to make more money. If you're going to ban us from competing, then we'll set up our own domestic league and European league. Do you not run that risk?
I think that is a potential, because remember that the Premier League is a separate institution English Football League.
Absolutely.
Now, albeit, and you know, we've got to give the right credit here, I think the Premier League clubs, or the people involved at least, they did go through the right protocols because they got approval from the Football Association. But you're absolutely right. And I think there is talk in the Premier League about introducing a similar rule. Where that would leave a scenario where another Super League was being created is uncertain, because the unfortunately the Football Association at present doesn't have a lot of credibility domestically following Greg Clark's somewhat calamitous end to his career, and there is a bit of a void there, so it's not showing leadership. Could clubs just say, well, we will set up a separate Premier League and invite another half a dozen clubs along, and that will be a sealed division as well. And the Football Association says, well, we won't let you play in the FA Cup. And they'll just turn around and say, okay.
Fair enough, yeah. Two more stories, Kieran, before we get to that really rather nice interview. Firstly, Zlatan Ibrahimovic is being investigated by UEFA over, and I quote, an alleged financial interest in a betting company. I imagine he greeted that news with an indifferent yet slightly arrogant shrug, the sort that producer guy gives when you ask him where their money is. Just to clarify, is he being accused of making bets or of having an investment in a betting company?
No, I think the accusation is that Zlatan Ibrahimovic owns 10% of a company called Bethard, which is based in Malta, where there seems to be an awful lot of gambling companies for such a small island. And this would be a breach of the rules of UEFA, because you know there is a potential conflict of interest here. You know, if he was to win, but to me, you know, my gut reaction is that it, you know, is that any hugely different from the position of Bet365, who owns Stoke, who in theory could say, okay, boys, you know, make sure you concede four tonight, because we've got some big money on it. So yeah, it does seem a bit of a strange one. You know, Bet365 have been really good for Stoke City Football Club financially, and you know, as you know, I'm not the biggest fan of the betting industry, but they've been very good for employment in the potteries industry. Did I tell you I used to run a potteries company?
Surprisingly enough, Kieran, no, hang on, let me just check my list here. Hang on, I'll just do some paper. No, I can't see any. No, hang on, let me see. I've got sex shop, gay nightclub, Blackpool, drug dealers, hang on, Barbados. No, you didn't.
No, I did. Yeah, that had gone bust. Yeah, that was very good. Yeah, fantastic people. Love the people who spoke.
This is not where we got that 5,000 job lot of Price of Football mugs from, is it?
Yeah, the ones which
we still have.
Yeah, with football with 1-0. Yeah.
Creating scarcity, guy said. yes, I understand, Kieran. We sort of joked about your conversations with Gordon Brown last time, but I understand that gambling in football was one of the issues he was quite keen to talk about.
Yes, I mean, the gambling industry benefits significantly from football because it provides a market which appeals to the demographics which they're chasing. And with the with smartphone technology, you can put on 50 or 60 bets during a match, and indeed, I have friends who do so, and they say it's part of the enjoyment. And there was certainly a narrative until probably 2 or 3 years ago, when perhaps views hardened against the industry, that it's more enjoyable when you place a bet on a match. And you know, we talk to people from those people that have suffered from gambling, they were sucked into that, and you know, lots of people have lost as a result. One of the things that was mentioned in the conversation with Gordon Brown was, well, you know, we have a levy as far as horse racing is concerned. Could there be a levy on football bets, which goes into grassroots football? Although my personal view is that I don't see why the football industry should be making up for a cutbacks from central and local government, because that's why there aren't the pitches and the facilities these days. But that's a much broader issue. Yeah. And yet Gordon Brown, you know, took that on board. Bet365, you know, I've mentioned them once already. You know, when I had to speak to the all-party parliamentary group on gambling, I did mention that Bet365's total wages received were 50% of the annual NHS budget.
Wow.
So how did they respond? Well, in this set of accounts, they're not showing the total value of the bets they've received, which is not much of a victory for anybody.
No.
But in terms – back on topic. He has been charged, Zlatan Ibrahimovic, and the penalties, he could face up to a €100,000 fine, which, let's be honest, he's not going to miss.
Yeah.
But he could also face up to a 3-year suspension from the game, which, you know, realistically would effectively terminate his career. Which, you know, and you know, I've seen him play. He is a magnificent footballer. And you know, he's controversial with it, but you know, I think it would be a loss to the game if he disappeared.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Our last story, Kieran, it seemed slightly comical when it first started, when Spotify founder Daniel Ek publicly stated his willingness to buy Arsenal while a game was going on. But even though his bid has since been joined by Thierry Henry, Dennis Bergkamp and Patrick Vieira, three of the greatest players to grace the Premier League, I think you'd agree, it seems to be going nowhere, because the Cronky has issued a very, 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 very firm statement last night to say Arsenal is not for sale under any circumstances.
Yeah, the trouble I have with this bunch is that I keep mistaking them for the Crankies. and we both have a few showbiz stories involving those, which can't get past producer guy on the pod. Because we do have an audience which is some we've got some younger members of the audience. Arsenal Football Club is a private company. So Stan Kroenke owns practically all of the shares. There's a few splattered about amongst a few other investors, but he owns as many, you know, a huge number of shares. A few years ago, Elisha Usmanov owned 30% of Arsenal, and he had been trying to get appointed to the board of directors. And even owning 30% of the club, Stan Kroenke used to turn around and say, "No, you know, I've got 65%, and I can do what I want." So I think what we've got here is a very stubborn billionaire. So whilst Daniel Ek has put out a public offer, and that offer, I believe, according to the newspapers, is around about £1.8 billion, and that did tie in to a valuation I did about 3 or 4 years ago. And remember Thomas Markham, who came on the show?
Yes.
Well, I used Thomas's model, and it was 99.8% or 99.7% accurate at the time. Right. So he's a very clever guy, Tom. I suspect that Stan Kroenke wants a wee bit more, because otherwise why not hold on to the club? He is worth 2 or 3 times the amount of money that Daniel Ek has. So he's very much in a position to say no. He's had his nose put out of joint by Super League, and I don't think he wants the humiliation of being forced out of town by a new kid on the block. So it was a very public offer. I did see that Arsene Wenger said the best deals are done in private, and this one is being conducted on Twitter. I can understand the positions there. I think it would be very challenging to force this one forwards from where we are at present.
Interesting to hear you say that the Kroenkes are worth 2 or 3 times more than Daniel Ek, because the way the story was initially presented, certainly on Friday night when it first came out, was that this guy Daniel Ek could buy and sell the Kroenkes, and that this pretty much they would have no choice but to bow down to this ultra-rich billionaire. But that's a tautology, obviously. But of course, it turns out that's not the case. I was quite surprised when you told me that.
Yeah. I mean, the trouble is we're talking about, you know, ultra-high net worth individuals, and where it trying to get a definitive determination of their wealth is difficult because they have many fingers and they have many pies. But Stan Kroenke has been very successful, whereas Daniel Ek is still young. And yes, Spotify is a very successful product, and he's made a lot of money on the back of that. And unlike the musicians whose music is shown on Spotify, but that's for a separate pod. But if you've got a private company, you it's private for a reason, and you are able to simply say no to any offers and be under no pressure. Whereas if it was a public company and somebody made a public offer for it, then the directors sort of are duty bound to act in the best interests of all shareholders. The trouble is here, all shareholders is effectively Stan Kroenke, and Stan Kroenke will do whatever's in the best interest of himself.
Speaking of American owners, it's interview time, Kieran. We managed to get a chat with Brett Johnson, who's co-chair of American club Phoenix Rising, who is now co-owner of Ipswich Town and has already made a very significant promise to Ipswich fans. Now, Brett, the first question, and it's an important one, Brett, is are you absolutely committed to getting that tattoo?
Oh, that would be one of the happier days of my life. Absolutely. I appreciate it. I guess for context to your listeners, I have gone on record with stating that we get Ipswich up to the Premier League, I'll be getting a tattoo to memorialize that. So, yeah, I think that'll be a good day for me.
Have you already planned what the tattoo will be?
No, I've started to think about it a little bit. First and foremost, I got to kind of break it to my wife. I'm trying to take baby steps, but she doesn't follow me, you know, relative to any of this stuff. So I'm wondering whether or not one of her friends who maybe listens might kind of break the news to her, or I'll just kind of say to her on a future visit to Ipswich Road, God, wouldn't it be nice to have that logo just sitting on my shoulder?
In my experience, most wives are quite happy when you turn up with a giant horse tattoo on your shoulder for no apparent reason. Brett, before we talk about Ipswich, we are a global pod. So can you tell us first a little bit about your involvement with Phoenix Rising and what your ambitions still are for them?
Sure. Yeah. So by way of background, first of all, I should start by thanking you and telling you what an honor it is to be on your podcast. Thank you. So Brett Johnson, by way of background, about 7 years ago, I bought a USL franchise in Phoenix, Arizona called Arizona United. And then we rebranded it to Phoenix Rising. And I'm very fortunate to bring in an incredible group of partners. And one of my partners convinced young Didier Drogba to join us and finish up his career and join our ownership group. And as I described, we've kind of been one of the more successful minor league soccer franchises kind of on and off the pitch since that time. And then started to think about how to use football in the most positive sense to drive social and economic impact and change. And I started buying up some rights to additional markets. I own the rights to Rhode Island. And then I also acquired a team in Tucson, Arizona. Mm. And then along the way, my partner, my co-chairman in Phoenix Rising, Bear Kavakai, and then Mark Detmer and I, we started thinking about acquiring a club in England. And we had a couple attempts that didn't reach, you know, come to fruition. So we're thrilled that what I would describe in our third attempt, we were able to kind of structure a off-market investment to acquire Ipswich, and really, really excited and pleased with getting that deal done. And now the work really begins.
Was Didier Drogba one of the people that led you towards English football?
Possibly. I mean, we had been approached, like a lot of people, to kick the tires on Newcastle.
Really? You
know, we thought that was compelling. But again, I look at Newcastle and on a risk reward basis, incredible brand. But you know, if you're buying it at in the Premier League, you've got a lot of risk. It goes down.
Yeah,
and probably not a lot of appreciation other than, you know, what I would say is it's an unbelievable brand that's probably not kind of punching at its weight class. But, you know, happy for a lot of reasons that it kind of set us on a path to look at England and then again, ultimately get to the point where when we looked, all things considered, we just feel Ipswich is right team, right brand, right culture, right market. Right time. And so really pleased that, you know, with Marcus Evans' support, we were able to get this to the starting line.
Can I ask you what some of those reasons were then that they seemed to be the right fit for you so quickly?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at all the boxes that it's checked on the pitch, I mean, all the cups that it's won, the incredible pedigree of, you know, Alf Ramsey, Sir Bobby, et cetera, Portman Road, as you and I were talking about before. I mean, the iconic place to play. I mean, just such a proud history that unfortunately for, you know, the last decade plus, you know, it has been, you know, punching below its weight class, going in the wrong direction. And so I think, you know, relative to our aspirations, I think there's a lot of ways for us to bring it up and not too many ways for us to kind of bring it further down. I certainly hope that's the case.
You talked recently about the history, the pedigree, and the gravitas of Ipswich Town, which are all things that the fans want to hear. And to my generation and to Kieran's, they were a brilliant, swashbuckling, continental-style team back in the 80s. Presumably you're learning more about the history all the time, aren't you? And once you start to meet fans, you'll learn even more about it, won't you?
Yeah, every day. And I, you know, with whatever limited free time I have been kind of engaging with fans. And actually, right before this podcast, I was talking to a fan and he was telling me about his history with the club and then also just remarking about how it's a club that really would develop talent, would find and develop talent, you know, rather than kind of bringing in big names, you know, where anytime that they've tried that historically, you know, from that fan's perspective, you know, it didn't work out. And I appreciate that, you know, those kind of conversations, every single one of those kind of lead you to appreciate and understand, you know, what you're a part of. So I'm grateful for that.
And you said as well recently that to own a club, you have to live, eat, and breathe the stuff 24 hours a day. That's not been an approach that previous owners have always taken, has it?
Yeah, I mean, I think you see that in a lot of professional sports where, you know, someone reaches a certain milestone with their balance sheet and then looks at these as potential trophy assets. And I think, you know, maybe some of them can back into some success. But, you know, from my perspective, I've always kind of approached this as a business. I've always kind of felt, you know, by extension, it's not an ego play for me. I really want these clubs to succeed. And they've got to succeed by winning. And then they also have to succeed by being a big and important part of the community. And you know, that's where I feel very fortunate, starting with Phoenix and now extending over the pond, you know, to be working with clubs that really do have the ability to kind of positively impact the community. And I always feel an incredible responsibility. I honestly don't say this just, you know, for a soundbite. This is an asset that is part of the community. The success lives and dies by the support of the community. And I view my role as to be a steward to kind of make sure that the community feels that sense of ownership and pride. And I feel fortunate just to play whatever small role it is, kind of tipping the scale to hopefully that end.
You've just earned yourself a lot of brownie points because you've used the Price of Football's favourite word when it comes to ownerships, which is stewardship. Kieran in particular, and I'll bring Kieran in here because you've always argued, Kieran, that a club owner first and foremost is the steward of a club for a certain time, haven't you?
Yes, because the owners will be there, you know, ideally for as long as possible, but the club will live on for generations. And it's great to hear Brett say, you know, that's his perspective of it as well. I look forward to all his success at Ipswich. As somebody that's been there as an away fan, it's always been a great day out, and that's something which I think is unique in football.
Kieran, I want you to pay attention to questions running here. I know it's difficult sometimes when you're listening to me, but previous owner Brett Marcus Evans had to lend seven-figure sums to the club most seasons. So how do you address the challenge of being ambitious on the pitch and fiscally responsible off it?
Yeah, I mean, again, with utmost respect to Marcus for that commitment and to other owners, because as I describe it, it's certainly not for the faint of heart. Financially, it's not for the faint of heart relative to time. The amount of time that my partners and I put into all of the assets that we have a responsibility for, have the pride and joy of being a part of, it's a requisite. If you're not putting in those hours and really making sure you've got the right leadership off the pitch, getting the right players on the pitch, I struggle to understand how you'll be successful. I think our approach financially on this is, you know, we view every dollar that we put in as equity, if you will. We intend to be good stewards of that equity, and we're seeking a return on that equity. And for us, that's going to be because we ideally first stage get it promoted up, you know, the championship, and then from there, God willing, up to, you know, tattoo land, up to the EPL.
You've installed. Oh, sorry, I did. I wanted, that's terrible, isn't it? I accused Kieran of having no attention span, and I forget exactly what it is I was going to ask him. It started. The sum rumoured to have been paid for the club is around £40 million, which to me, Kieran, strikes as a bargain for a club with the potential and the size of Ipswich Town.
Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead, Kieran.
Yeah. As a League One club, I think it's a fair price, and I'm sure Brett's done his due diligence and has been in the data room. As a club in the Championship, then it starts to tip, and once you get into the Premier League, then clearly it is a good price. But as Brett, I'm sure has done his homework. They're not easy steps, and competing in the Championship is. Is a license to lose money, unfortunately.
Mm. Brett, you've installed Mark Ashton as CEO. He was Championship CEO of the Year in 2019, and he obviously knows English football inside and out. What do you hope to gain from him other than insight?
Yeah, I mean, let's start from the fact that I think as an American who, along with my American partners, have tasted some success in North America, I think the greatest sin we could have taken was to think somehow our success could translate to England. And so, to that end, I always felt kind of, England's where smart money goes to die. If you don't really get someone, what I would describe as English, to really steer the ship. And I had the pleasure of meeting Mark Ashton several years ago at a USL board meeting and was beyond impressed with the pragmatic, disciplined approach that he takes both kind of on and off the pitch. And, that impressed me. And as I thought to myself, if I ever have the opportunity to invest or own any asset in that fine country, I wanted someone like Ashton, in the tent, if you will, on the team. And so thrilled to have him. And I think, that accolade that he won in 2019 is appropriate. His eye for signing talent and for monetizing it is very positive, because we look at it as well. These clubs, you do want to make sure that you can find ways to find commercial success in addition to, obviously, performance success, if you will. And we hope to strike the balance between the two. But I'm thrilled to have him at the helm. I mean, I think Paul Cook, I've been very impressed with what he's done, and I think he's the right manager for the club. And we're going to be busy, in this transfer window, and hopefully can really bring in the talent that's going to just, not stop at anything until, this club is again, at a minimum, back up a championship.
There was talk of dramatic wholesale changes over the summer. Is that just to playing staff?
No, I think we're gonna change not just the playing staff, but we're gonna invest in Portman Road. I mean, my understanding from a distance is it's a fairly tired venue, and I think there's probably a fair bit of what I'll call low hanging fruit of changes to, you know, really have that the supporters that come first and foremost, they recognize it on the pitch. You know, nothing more important for us than immediately having what I'll say is that the 18 that are dressing are going to do whatever it takes and literally to win, to get those 3 points, you know, week in and week out, game in and game out. But that being said, I mean, I certainly want all of the fans, the supporters that come from such great distances to support this club and who have stuck with this club during such dark days.
Absolutely, yeah.
I want them to kind of sit there and be like, you know what, I noticed the food was better. I know the seat was cleaner. I noticed the scoreboard was new, you know, just all those elements of it where they go away and, you know, ideally they start to turn to others in their universe and say, hey, you got to join me next time at Portman Road. You know, we're really starting to, the club's going in the right direction.
Yeah, you might start by doing something about the wall at the back of the away end, because last time I was there, I accidentally knocked myself out over exuberantly celebrating what turned out to be a disallowed goal. It's very hard concrete, Brett. You might like to do something about that.
Okay, we might get you a helmet too. It sounds like you get very...
You know, that's not a bad idea, actually, like a toddler. Yeah, it might be safer to put a toddler's helmet on it. You mentioned talking to individual fans earlier on, Brett, and it's clear that you're already establishing a relationship with them. How do you plan to engage with Ipswich Town fans as a community about your plans? Do you intend to keep them involved in what you're going to do and keep them involved at every level of the consultation process?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As much as I can. You know, there's a limit, you know, to a certain degree, but, you know, I'm blown away. You know, early on, this gentleman, Graham Brooke, had reached out to me about his book, Adventures of a Tractor Boy. Mm-hmm. And I was very quick, you know, and, you know, to buy a copy. He wanted to send me one. I said, look, I appreciate that. I'm going to buy it. And, you know, read it and, was in awe of his support. And, you know, if we could clone individuals like Graham, you know, and in many respects, there are thousands of them, you know, in Ipswich, and there are thousands of them with these clubs all across the world. I mean, they really do. Their commitment is inspiring. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those elements that one of many reasons why we will work tirelessly to make this club a success is to reward individuals like Graham, and by extension, everyone that commits so much and that this means the world to them. I've enjoyed starting to develop a relationship with him. I've started, you know, engaging with a lot of fans. The outreach through, you know, whether it's LinkedIn or Twitter, et cetera, has been positively overwhelming. And I slowly try to chip away at it and just acknowledge if someone took the time to reach out to me and say thank you and hello, I try to at a minimum just acknowledge and appreciate their support. And don't take any of it for granted. And I probably, in some respects, you know, no matter how hard we invest, how cautiously optimistic I am in terms of us getting this moving in the right direction. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, sometimes the ball doesn't bounce the way you're going to. We're going to have a couple games that are not going to go our way. And I guess I want as much goodwill as possible when, you know, during those days where, you know, you might have a bad run of form for a couple of weeks.
Do you know the very name Tractor Boys, Brett, is one of the beautiful things about English football, where fans take something that was originally meant as an insult and claim it as their own. And are now proudly call themselves a tractor. You'll hear many versions of how that name came about, and eventually you probably will get fed up with being asked how much you hate Norwich. But in the meantime, it's a lovely journey. It's really exciting for Ipswich fans, I imagine, to hear you talk about falling in love with the club in the way you are, and falling in love with fan culture. Can I ask you though, Brett, about a bigger thing? Can I ask for your thoughts on the Super League, and in particular, has it made it harder for fans, do you think, to trust American owners?
Yeah, I think so, and rightly so. As I said, Berkay and I were very quick to kind of, as I describe it, be on the right side of that. But that wasn't even a debate for us. It was, it was just natural and instinctive. I had a lot of friends reach out to me, immediately ask me what my thoughts were, and I was very quick to say, I hope it dies a very quick and painful death. And I'm very pleased that it did. What I find interesting is whether it has any repercussions in some respects in North America. you know, in the sense, like in the sense, does it potentially start to precipitate more of a dialogue about pro-rel in these markets here? I don't say this because I play in a league that would benefit from promotion, because, you know, over the last 3 years, Phoenix Rising would have been promoted, you know, each of the last 3 years if we had that system. And I honestly don't say it because I sit there and go, God, wouldn't that be great? We just save a lot of money. You know, we go up, we'd be worth that much more money. I genuinely believe it's just a lot more exciting.
Mm.
You know, it, and it's not just in the sport of football. I mean, you can watch an NBA game kind of early in the season that has almost no bearing between two teams. You know, at some point, if they're no good, you start wondering about what their draft pick is going to be versus, wait a second, we might actually go down a league. And so you'll find few Americans, I think, that are a bigger advocate or proponent of pro-rel than I am.
Hmm. It's one of the things that we talk about a lot on the pods, Brett, and it's one of the things that English football fans in particular are still surprised by, is the democratic way that American sport is run, as you'd say, draft picks, distribution of merchandising wealth, etc. Are you aware of what most football fans consider a very unequal distribution of money in English football?
Yeah. I mean, it's fairly clear, and I think it became even more clear by this, you know, ostensible power grab that again, you know, failed miserably. But I think it's a sign. In some respects, it wasn't necessarily a sign of strength. It might, you know, you could look at it as a sign of weakness, just given, you know, what I would describe as kind of the irresponsible nature of the sort of balance sheet management of some of those bigger clubs. I mean, it's staggering to think the sums that gets expended with very little or no return. It'll be interesting to see what the ultimate reckoning is, relative to those clubs, relative to some of the American owners associated with it. I do probably suspect a fair bit of it will blow over time, but we'll see. I also usually say whatever my pundit is, you should take the opposite of. So keep that in mind too.
Yeah, Kieran does that with me pretty much. That's how the pod works. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, Brett. As away fans, as I mentioned, Kieran and I have had some great days at Portman Road. And I'm not ashamed to admit that you and I were chatting while Kieran was trying to work the technology. God love him. And the first thing I said to you basically was, if you could get the Drum and Monkey pub reopened in Ipswich, that would be fantastic. But do you know when you'll be able to get here for the first time, when you'll be able to visit Portman Road for the first time?
Yeah, so I'm really hoping in August, as soon as that first sort of home fixture of the new season is calendared. I've been easier to break it to my wife about trying to make that trip than I have about talking about a tattoo. But now I got to add the Drum and Monkey to the list.
Well, not only that, but also you've promised to take your daughter to Hogwarts. Have you told her?
I know. I can't wait. You're going to have to show me where it is.
Well, it's not near Ipswich. That's the problem. Okay. You may have there.
Right.
You told your daughter, don't worry, I've bought this club. It's right next to Hogwarts.
Right. That's right. No, it's my kids are excited, which makes the journey that much more enjoyable. But, you know, again, from my perspective, gentlemen, it's an honor to be on your show. And Kieran, I really am enjoying your book. As I said, I did kind of cut to the chase and go right to the post-COVID world that I need to focus on. But all that being said, it's an unbelievable body of work. And I intend on digesting it and just kind of recognizing all the things I've been doing wrong for the last 6 years.
Thank you very much.
Brett, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. You talk about exciting. I imagine Ipswich fans will be very exciting listening to this conversation, because it sounds like they're about to embark on a great new adventure, and we wish them all the very best of luck, and we wish you the very best of luck in the future as well. Thank you, Brett.
I thank you. I thank you so much. What a pleasure. Appreciate it.
There's a few things to unpack from that interview, Kieran. And as I say, he came across as a very likeable, very nice chap. I enjoyed talking to him. First thing, he's read your book then?
Yeah, well, that's what happens when you send people copies of your book, Kevin.
Ah, okay. You just send them random copies and hope somebody will pick. In case I've now shamed him into reading mine, I should also own up to a little white lie that I told in that interview. I did knock myself out at Ipswich in an away match, but it wasn't at the back of the away end. It was in an executive box. And I didn't feel, I know Brett's finding his way in English football. I didn't feel that the concept of blagging your way into an executive box and then getting so bladdered that you forgot the difference between a concave and a convex window, which is exactly what happened, really. Just concave, convex, who knows? It just came out of nowhere. But also there's a couple of serious points there. I like the fact that he's clearly buying into the culture of Ipswich Town, and that's great. He's learnt the history. He's passionate. He's talking to fans. But he's also honest enough to admit that he's doing this to make money. But some of the money, Kieran, comes from an investment fund that also manages Arizona State Pensions. Will that affect the club's approach? Will they have to be a bit more cautious when they're talking about money that's being invested in a public benefit?
I think major decisions would have to be approved. But, and this is not disrespecting Ipswich Town Football Club, the value of the Arizona State Pension Fund is so huge that Ipswich Town doesn't register on it.
Right, okay.
So, you know, I think they'll give them a fair degree of latitude as to how they choose to behave. But I'm more concerned now that you've confessed Waitrose and going in executive boxes. Your man of the people position is slipping here, Kevin, if you don't mind me saying so.
I think you'll find Nye Bevan said that if a football fan could get, in the speech he made in 1946, only the best. No, literally, we blagged our way in. It's a very long story. who knows? Why would you even have concave or conv? Why would you have mirrors that stick out like portholes on a ship? Not mirror, windows. Anyway, long story. It was only, we were an hour into the train journey home before they were able to tell me that the goal I was celebrating had actually been disallowed.
Oh, no.
I know, we'd lost 3-0. I thought we would won 1-0, we'd lost 3-0. It was a good night, though.
Excellent.
But I think, with all due respect to Ipswich fans as well, I think the big news that came out of that interview would interest Newcastle fans, the fact that he was seriously looking at, and he said it went way beyond tire-kicking, that he was seriously in the market to buy Newcastle United and decided it wasn't worth it.
Yeah, and Newcastle, to get Newcastle up to the next level would involve an awful lot of money, because it's not just competing against the big six anymore. We have seen Leicester, Leeds United, I think Villa. You know, they've had owners that have come in and have spent. I think he's perhaps looking at it from the perception of, to a certain extent, you're going to get involved in an arms race because you're competing for players in that particular pool, and there's more and more clubs trying to get them. And it's going to cost you £300 million to start off with. We've seen the owners of Liverpool, FSG, that they bought Liverpool Football Club for $300 million and could sell it today for five or six times that amount of money very easily. So if you get it right, it's great. But you know, Liverpool, to a certain extent, were a bargain at £300 million a decade ago. And FSG benefited from the fact that the club had been run poorly by Hicks and Gillette, and who'd put the club on the brink, and they therefore picked the club up to a certain extent as a distressed asset.
It certainly sounds, though, that Ipswich fans are in for a quite exciting time. It certainly sounds like they're in safe hands financially anyway, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah. I mean, we've had communication with Brett Johnson since, and he wants to come on the show again to show what he's doing in the US. And I think that would be a fascinating listen, because it would broaden our horizons, because he's very much committed to the idea of clubs being the focal point of the community and all the good that they can do in bringing people together. And I think that's something which, you know, if I'm honest, at the start of when we, you know, go back to when we started this show, I was sort of aware of, but I've been coming sort of increasingly more and more committed to that position, because you know, we've had the opportunity to talk to the people at, you know, Tranmere and Accrington and Lincoln and other clubs where this is so much central to their ambitions for the club.
Mm. Kieran, it's Questions Day on Monday, so if you have, lovely listeners, any questions at all on any aspect of football finance, then email us on questions@priceoffootball.com. We didn't have time in the last pod for you to say your traditional goodbye, Kieran, but we've got a spare minute, I reckon, before we hit Guy's golden overtime clock. So I'll pass it over to you to say goodbye.
Well, thanks again, folks, for your feedback and support. If you could press the follow button, it's no longer a subscribe button on that big Apple podcast or your Spotify podcast. And, you know, for Arsenal fans, you could be helping somebody take over the tenuous link. If you could give us a review as well, give us those 5 stars. It genuinely makes a difference. I think we got up to number 12 in the sports podcast charts last week following Super League. It's just that, you know, if producer Guy or Kevin or myself or, you know, we approach somebody such as Brett Johnson or somebody else in the football industry and say, we're a couple of old blokes grumbling about football finance. Do you fancy coming on the show? One of the first things that they're going to do is to see where we are in the charts. And those 5-star reviews, we don't know how the Apple algorithm works, but we do know that it makes a difference. So, you know, apart from that, thank you very much for your support. And take care, everybody.
You see, that's sensible advice for getting algorithm sorted. My advice to Guy was phone people up in a Swiss accent. Automatically assume that they're on a decent pod. Bye, everybody. The Price of Football. Price of Football.